Case number 13-1060, Palm Wonderful LLC et al. Petitioners versus Federal Trade Commission. Mr. Goldstein for the petitioner, Mr. Nectarline for the respondent.
Mr. Goldstein, you want to talk about implied messages?
I do. Chief Judge Garland, and may it please the Court, I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I think, Your Honors, that the big issue in the case that the parties have not been as helpful about as they might, that I really want to focus on and I think I can genuinely help with, is when is it that an FTC order banning speech is subject to ordinary First Amendment review, and when is it subject to deferential review under the APA? And that, I think, is the pivot point in the case. And there are legal issues in the case that the parties agree on, and let me just make those clear. We agree that the FTC has the power to read an ad on its face, that is to say, without any extrinsic evidence whatsoever, and determine that it contains an implied message. We also agree that if it validly makes that determination, it's going to get deferential APA review on the question of what substantiation is required and whether that substantiation has been satisfied in the case. Here's where we disagree. We think that we win this case for either of two reasons. Reason number one, the FTC is wrong to say that it gets deferential review from cradle to grave. It says that its determination that the ad is clear on its face is something that you have to defer to. We think that is wrong in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Peel. Reason number two, we think that the FTC adopted a legal rule in the case that is inconsistent with the requirement that the ad has to be clear on its face. We believe, and we can show, that they applied a standard that so long as the ad draws a link between the product and health effects, it reads the ad as if it makes a claim of clinical proof that the product prevents, treats, or reduces the risk of, say, heart disease or something like that. We think that if you look at the case, you will find either that the ads in your de novo review, which we think is appropriate, don't come anywhere near saying that we prevent, treat, or cure heart disease, or at the very least that the legal standard the FTC applied was wrong. So if I could just take us to the advertisements, and I think that the way we think this case works is like the last case, and that is you're going to look at the objective evidence and make a threshold determination of whether there was a mistaken impression at the beginning. Was it clear? And if so, then just as you would defer to the district judge's sentence, so too you will defer to other things the FTC does. So if I could start us in our reply brief, the gray brief, in the appendix of advertisements at the back, I'd like to start with addendum 2. And what the FTC says is that this, you will conclude that this ad clearly implies that POM, here the pill, prevents, cures, or treats heart disease, ED, or prostate cancer. So if we just look at the words, in big red print, right below the picture, findings from a small study suggest that pomegranate juice may one day prove an effective weapon against prostate cancer. I apologize, we're in our great brief, addendum 2.
Well, I understand where you are. Is that one of the ones where the ALJ ruled in your favor?
Yes, I think it's a good point, and that is the ALJ does, and then...
It's a good point because the FTC said it doesn't have to look at those. It reached the same conclusion based only on the ones where the ALJ ruled in its favor, correct?
No. So the government represents to you...
No, I'm only asking you what the FTC's opinion
said. The FTC's opinion said... Even if we agreed with just the ALJ,
yes,
we would agree that injunctive relief is appropriate.
Yeah.
The commission's brief misquotes that as if the commission said, even if we agreed with the ALJ, this injunctive relief would be appropriate. That is not what the language in the opinion says.
Where does that misquotation
come from? Absolutely. That is, and you'll just have to give me one moment. So this is going to be at page 20 of their brief.
What page of the... opinion.
50. So I'm going to quote you what they say and then what the ALJ says. Here's their brief. Quote, the commission emphasized that this injunctive remedy, referring to what the commission had done, would have been justified, quote, even if based only on the smaller number of ads where the ALJ found petitioners conveyed the claim. Here's what the opinion actually says. At page 50, it describes I just don't see it on the exact part of the page.
Isn't it the carryover for 49 to 50?
Thank you. That's where it is. Nevertheless, injunctive relief, such as that ordered by Judge Chappelle, talking about a very different injunction. It's the injunction that you have to, thank you, Judge Srinivasan, it's the injunction that you have to have reasonable and competent scientific evidence, which is worlds apart from a requirement that we have two RCTs, the gold standard that's applied in drug cases, to make any health claim by anybody in the company. So that's what the ALJ, what the FTC said. Now, the reason that would come into play in the case is if you concluded essentially that the ALJ got it right and the FTC was too aggressive and you were trying to decide what to do with the case then, would you then say it's inevitable that the FTC would just do the same thing? And for the reason I just gave, it isn't. The FTC didn't claim that in any way. It said it would affirm Judge Chappelle's injunction. Now what I want to do is address the premise, and that is, should you rule that the ALJ's disposition of the case was the appropriate one, because the ALJ had a more appropriate view of when it is that we were making an implied claim.
Can I just pause on this a little bit more? In footnote 3, Commissioner Olhausen, who is the one upon which you mostly rely, says she supports an order requiring at least one RCT, right? And that's based on her pretty much agreement with the ALJ with respect to which ads are appropriate and are misleading, which aren't, right?
That's correct. And we disagree with the number of ads that Judge Olhausen found would contain this implied establishment claim. And we also disagree with her view that that remedy is appropriate. And so I'm going to talk in general about the former and why it is I don't think our ads make these claims. But as to the latter, the reason is that the ads that most concern the Commission and the ads that we've conceded are most aggressive are ads that weren't run from 2005 on. And we think when you're talking about a remedy that is extremely restrictive of speech, then you really have to decide either A, were these people intentionally flouting the law, and this is a standard that didn't pre-exist this case, or B, is there some real indication of a continuing commitment to engage in speech like this? And when the ads that are so concerning are ones that haven't run for 9 years, that remedy we think is overbroad. So, having answered the court's questions about, you know, there are three different ways that people have looked at the case. There's the Commission's ruling, Commissioner Olhausen's view about one RCT, and the ALJ's view that we have to have reasonable and competent scientific evidence. I do want to turn, if it's all right, to the two errors that we think exist in the case. Error number one is that when we're talking about the legal standard, that the implication has to be clear that we are preventing, curing, or making less likely a disease, is that the Commission applied a legal rule that it's any connection between a health claim and the product that's sufficient. And if I could just take you to the language that announces that legal rule and explain why it is that that's not consistent with the CLEAR standard. And so if you turn to the Commission, the order of the Commission at page 11 and then page 13. So in page 11, they give the...
Where are you in the JA?
Yes, I'm in JA 595. We're in volume 2. Yeah. And I'll give you JA sites from here on. So I'm on 595. This is where the Commission links the claims appendix, which starts with its rules of construction, including particularly you have these qualifications, we won't pay attention to them, to the outcome and why it is it finds 34 different ads have these claims. And so I mean the first full paragraph below the block quote in the penultimate sentence. This is their explanation. Respondents' ads drew a logical connection between the antioxidant claims and the specific disease treatment or prevention claims through the associated explanatory text, the specific findings of the study results, and references to diseases or medical conditions. And then 2 pages later, so I'm on JA 597, in the second full paragraph that begins, respondents argue, Six lines down, there's a line that begins clinical proof. And this is them rejecting our argument at the end of that line. We disagree. As we explain in the claims appendix, these ads drew a logical connection between the study results and effectiveness.
I'm sorry, can you point that out?
Yes, of course. Second full paragraph. I am six lines down.
Page, which page?
I apologize, 597. The line starts clinical proof. It's five lines down. Across to the right, we disagree. As we explained in the claims appendix, these ads drew a logical connection between the study results and effectiveness for the particular diseases. And that's the standard that they're applying. And we can illustrate
that. It does not seem to me to be the standard that they're applying. That seems like one sentence out of several hundred in the opinion. The opinion says that they're accepting that a claim was made here that the challenged POM products treat, prevent, or reduce the risk of heart disease, prostate cancer, and ED.
Right. And our point, Your Honor,
not just that there's a logical connection, but that it makes that...
We're not saying something different. What I'm saying is an antecedent point to yours, Your Honor, and that is the commission, when it reaches the conclusion, it's clear that these make the implied claims. It's applying a legal standard. It's saying there are times that we are going to automatically infer that claim, and that is whenever it's not a fact by, you know, case by case, ad by ad analysis. They do apply their standards to each ad, but they have this standard that is, if you draw a logical connection between your product and health, you are necessarily implying that you are going to prevent your cure or treat a disease. And if I could give you one other piece of evidence of our view of what the opinion did, if you go to our reply brief at page 7, well, you don't even have to do that. You could go either to the claims.
How does that square with their statements at other pages that say that what we find is that I'm wonderful drew causal connections between its product and effective treatment of these diseases, and then goes on in three examples to discuss three of the ads in which they conclude not just that there's a logical connection, but that they find a causal connection. Why should we assume they haven't looked at every ad? I don't understand.
Your Honor, I'm not saying they haven't looked at every ad. As in many contexts, the agency articulated a rule and applied the rule to reach a conclusion. The rule that
I know you think that, but I'm not seeing that they've applied a rule which requires only a logical connection, except for one sentence out of a very long opinion, most of which says not a logical connection, but a causal relationship.
Right. Your Honor, maybe I can just illustrate why I think I'm right, that when they say a causal relationship, it's because they derive that from the logical connection. So if we could just look at an ad and see whether or not it's remotely plausible.
Maybe you want to look at one of the ads that the both the FTC and the and the ALJ said.
Sure.
Let me ask you to look at one myself. Okay. So that one would be Exhibit 15.
So Figure 15.
Figure 15.
The 2007 press release.
Yeah, that's right.
So JA-692.
I'm looking at JA-692 and 693. Let me just ask you about that. So 692 says that this randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind, crossover pilot study examined the efficacy of pomegranate juice versus placebo, right?
Yes. That's not quite right. It does say, according to a pilot study.
It says this randomized
second paragraph.
Yes.
It does say pilot in it after saying randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind, and crossover.
Yeah.
Right? And then on the next page, 693, it says efficacy was assessed using the IEEF and the GAQ questionnaires, correct?
Yes.
It says the IIEF is a validated questionnaire, correct?
Yes.
And then it goes on and gives the results in which it says that the p-value was 0.058, right?
Under the GAQ, yes.
Well, it doesn't say under the GAQ, right? It first says that you have a validated questionnaire, the IIEF, and then it gives a p-value of 0.058.
Yes.
Right?
That is
not the p-value, not even close to the p-value for the IIEF, is it?
That's correct.
And the p-value for the IIEF is 0.72, right?
I think that's correct.
Right. And your brief makes fun of the statistical ability of the other side.
Yeah.
You understand that a p-value of 0.72 is not even close to being statistically significant.
Yes, but neither is it what the government says, which is this group. It's a negative study. It's not statistically significant.
Yes, but you don't see that it's a valid implication from this, where they say that they're using a validated questionnaire and that it has a p-value of 0.058, and not to mention that that's not the p-value for the validated questionnaire.
Okay, a few things about this. I will completely address your question. Let me just start from the big picture.
You don't have to confess error.
That I am not about to do.
Neither did the other guy.
Point number one, there are going to be several. Point number one, the basis for the commission's conclusion here was not that we were misleading consumers by the reference to the IIEF measure. The commission does say that this is not sufficient proof. It is not a sufficient RCT because of this point about the IIEF. But the commission's holding as to this ad and every other ad is that we had insufficient substantiation. The government's brief in this court tries to turn that into something very different, which is that we are misleading people. So just at the threshold, that as if we were burying science, that we were that the commission held that we were conveying misleading information, as opposed to simply the commission said this study wasn't strong enough to prove that you had scientific proof. So that's point one.
But that is after they already found that you were making a claim that you did have scientific proof, right?
Right.
How can you say that's not? If they conclude that you have implied that you have scientific substantiation, and in fact you don't,
yeah,
that's misleading.
Okay, Your Honor. We're not disagreeing. I get that.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that the government makes a different argument about this in the brief that I want to make sure the court isn't mistakenly buying.
I'm interested in the argument that the FTC makes in its opinion.
And that's what I'm trying to make sure we do focus on. So long as we both understand, Your Honor, that the government's suggestion that the FTC, in fact, statement that the FTC found that we were hiding science and affirmatively misstating the science is not the basis for the FTC's opinion. That's all I'm saying. Now, you are quite right that the FTC, with respect to this press release, does say that this is an establishment claim. That is, you are claiming scientific proof. Now, what we disagree with that with respect to this advertisement because it is an accurate recitation, we think, of the study. If we cannot describe the study in this detail, including the p-value, and if we have to face the FTC's complaint that it's only 94.2% rather than 95%,
yes, but the problem here is not the 94 versus the 95. The problem is really 72%. It's actually 28% is the problem, right, because of the p-value.
Right. There's a 28% chance that we are wrong.
No. There's only a 28% chance that you are right.
On that one measure. Yeah. And there is a 6% chance that we're wrong on the other measure.
Okay. But right. to not disclose the – it's not really – even that's not accurate. It's a 28% chance that the results seen here are not the consequence of random behavior,
yeah,
right? So – or of you having no effect.
Right.
So I don't understand how, if you look at those two paragraphs, that you can regard that as not misleading.
Your Honor, because
it doesn't cite the p-value of the study. You tout one of the questionnaires as being valid, and then you give the p-value for the other questionnaire.
I understand the difference. And that is, you can imagine the FTC is holding that this press release is sanctionable because it's misleading for the reason that you've given.
Well, okay, that's one reason, but that's one of the possible reasons.
Yeah. That's right. But what I'm saying is the one you're focusing on. That is, what you're describing, Your Honor, is that you released a misleading press release. There were two metrics that you said, and then you gave the answer for one. You omitted the other. You misled people in that respect. Or you could say what the FTC said in its order as the basis for imposing liability, which is, this does not rise to the level of scientific proof. And if I could just explain to you where it is that the FTC actually says it. So I'll just give you a quote from their brief and then what the commission actually said.
Let's go into what the commission actually said,
sure,
because that's what we,
yeah,
need to care about, as you accurately point out.
Yeah.
At JA 617, they,
yes,
say, the GAQ results came close to statistical significance.
Your Honor, could I just ask where you are on the
page? Yes, I'm in the third, the second full paragraph on page 617.
Yes.
Third line, approximately the third line. The GAQ is not a validated instrument, right?
Yes.
Which is not mentioned in this. All you mentioned is that the IIEF is a validated
instrument. We actually do believe that many people treat this as a validated measurement. That we cite, I think, their experts in our reply brief. So I don't think the non-validated metric, it's not your core point, which is the failure to reveal the IIED results. But on that point, we do think we have substantial evidence that this is a valid marker.
Right. So it says the study also used the IIEF, which is a validated tool. The IIEF results were nowhere near approaching statistical significance.
Right, and then the question is, what conclusion do they draw from that? They could draw one of two conclusions as a basis for imposing liability. Conclusion number one, which you're describing, Your Honor, is that you put out a press release that's misleading. Conclusion, in the sense of you withheld information from the public. Conclusion number two is that you claim to have scientific proof and you did not have enough. And if I could just, so you've just, and let me just read to you what they do actually conclude, Your Honor, just to be fair to us, and that is, on page 617, they're affirming the determination of the ALJ, which is the beginning of the previous paragraph. As the ALJ determined, respondents did not possess the scientific evidence to substantiate their claims that clinical studies prove that the challenge products treat, prevent, or reduce the risk of ED, and then describe the study. And that, then let me give you their holding overall, which is completely consistent with how we're describing it. That is, if you go to JA 587,
wait, where was the sentence you just read?
Sure, it was the beginning of the previous paragraph, the introduction to that discussion. That's their holding. I also want to just be clear.
They're holding on substantiation, not their only holding, which is that there's a representation that you substantiated and then that you didn't.
But
right? There's a combination of the two here. It's not just that you don't have substantiation.
Your Honor, I agree that just an absence of substantiation in the air is not the problem. The point is this. It is a substantiation problem. It is not a misstating the results of the study problem. So they found that we were representing that we could treat, prevent, or reduce the risk of ED. Okay, that's what they say the study implies.
Well, they say that had you done proper qualifications, as we said could be done in Pearson, you might not have a problem.
Okay, so can I read you one.
And by not stating the qualifying study, the qualifying consequence, you don't get into that protection.
Okay, so can I just read you the one sentence mm-hmm. from the opinion that is the actual holding, then turn to the disclaimer's mm-hmm. point about Pearson. The actual holding, I'm going to read you a sentence from page one of their brief and then read you the actual commission holding. So page one.
I think it would be helpful if you just focus on the actual one.
Your Honor, the reason I'm not doing that, and I understand what you think would be helpful, is that I believe they have misstated.
The reason I say this is you're 7 minutes over, and I assume you want to talk about some other topics, but if you,
I do.
Yeah. Okay. So if you want that, then you need to just answer our questions.
Okay. The holding of the commission at 587 is the basis of petitioner's liability is their lack of sufficiently reliable evidence, namely RCTs, to substantiate the claims we have found. That is the holding of the commission. Now, with respect to your Pearson question, here is what they say on the question of whether reasonable disclaimers would be sufficient to obviate their concerns. And so I have their brief at page 3. This is what they say is required for a disclaimer, and it is nothing like we respectfully submit what it is that Pearson describes. So they say, at the bottom of page 3 of their brief, advertisers remain generally free to inform consumers about a promising body of emerging science so long as they include clear qualifying language that discloses the limitations of the scientific record and the existence of any contrary evidence. And then they apply that at page 47, and to give you a sense of what they think a disclaimer is, and it is nothing like any disclaimer that is known to commerce.
I'm sorry, are you quoting from the opinion or from the brief?
I'm quoting from the brief. Uh-huh. And so this is what the FTC says its disclaimer rules. You said, Your Honor, that they describe disclaimers as being appropriate, and I'm explaining why it is they say that our qualifications aren't sufficient disclaimers. So they say at the bottom of 47, to avoid deceiving consumers, POM would have needed, at a minimum, to qualify its 50% claim, this is about 50% greater likelihood of improved directions, with the information that the cited study resulted on an unvalidated metric, that they fell short of statistical significance even under that metric, and that the results did not even approach statistical significance under the validated metric.
Did the FTC make that statement in an opinion?
I think that is very close.
This is an implementation. Can you point to me where in the opinion the FTC made that statement?
If you will let me do that on rebuttal, just so I can find it.
You've already run out of your rebuttal. That's the problem. That's why I was trying to help you save time.
Okay. Your Honor, I'm describing to you, as you say to me, they say you can have disclaimers.
That's what the FTC's opinion said. If they made disclaimers as in Pearson, this could be different, right?
I do not believe that they're describing Pearson. Let me put it this way. Pearson doesn't describe a disclaimer.
Doesn't
describe a particular disclaimer.
Well, that's not right. Being on the panel, I actually have some familiarity with that case. We said this concern could be accommodated, for example, by adding a prominent disclaimer to the label along the following lines. Quote, the evidence is inconclusive because existing studies have been performed with foods containing antioxidant vitamins, and the effect of those foods on reducing the risk of cancer may result from other components in those foods.
Okay,
and that's a pretty specific disclaimer that he suggested was required.
Your Honor, I don't think it said it was required.
Well, that the FTC had to consider. Those were the kinds of disclaimers we said the FTC had to consider.
And then there's a second thing that the court said that's important, and that is if it's going to reject whatever disclaimers are provided, it needs to do so on the basis of actual evidence. That it has to have an evidentiary basis for its position for rejecting disclaimers or qualifications. And our point, a critical point of our argument, is that what the FTC did here instead is a matter of law held that all of the qualifications that we have throughout our advertisements are irrelevant as a matter of law without any evidence to support that. And so the ads, while it's absolutely right, Your Honor, that you have pointed us to any advertisement that they are concerned with, it is equally true that we have a large number of advertisements that are full of qualifications, 6 or 7 of them, that the Commission deems irrelevant as a matter of law and refuses to attribute any weight to, and then nonetheless treats them as unqualified disease claims. And I do not want to impinge on the Court's patience by any means, but if it would help the Court, I would just like to give you just one illustration of my point.
Can I just ask what the point that you're making? Because I don't read in the Commission's order the sense that qualifications can never matter. You agree on that?
Yes.
And they do say that if qualifications of the kind at issue in Pearson had been made, we would consider the claims in light of that, meaning that they don't mean to foreclose qualifications of the kind that were made, that were suggested in
right.
Pearson.
Right. It is important in that language that they aren't saying that would be good enough. It says we would consider them.
Right. But in other words, it would be a different case.
It would be a different case. Fair enough. All right. So the point that I wanted to make, Your Honors, is that look at what they said was a clear implication of a disease claim. Under Peel, you have to decide de novo if you agree with the breadth of their reading of the ads. And if I could just take you to one of them. And I think, and so just the one I was going to use is on the addendum 2 of our brief. And I will promptly sit down so that I don't take up too much of your time.
We have some other questions. Why don't we start with the other questions and then we'll get to you.
Sure.
Judge Ginsburg.
The Commission, I think, found that with respect to all and nearly all of the ads, that they also applied efficacy.
Yes.
And if the Commission is correct about that, why do we need to deal with the substantiation point?
Because efficacy claims, unlike establishment claims, are handled under the Commission's Pfizer factors. If you were making an establishment claim, if you were to agree with them that we made an establishment claim and we claim scientific proof that we could cure cancer, for example, then they have the RCT standard. They get to hold us to that substantiation. By contrast, with respect to efficacy claims, that is to say, we can help, you know, we improve your chances or something like that. We don't claim scientific proof. Then there is the 6 Pfizer factors, and we brief these to you, and they include balancing the risk of the product, here nothing, because it's a healthy food, And the burden imposed by the commission's view, which is do an RCT or two RCTs.
Okay. Before we go down that road,
yeah,
and maybe we won't have to, if the commission did correctly apply FISA, and there's substantial evidence in the record to support that, then we would not need to deal with the substantiation issue that you've been addressing throughout your argument.
Well, Your Honor, I haven't been. I completely take the premise of the hypothetical. I have been dealing through my argument not with the question of substantiation, but their method of claim interpretation. So if you were, let me just say what I think you would have to do.
But isn't it relevant primarily, or maybe exclusively, to the substantiation issue?
To the establishment claims?
Yes.
No, I think not, and here's why. And that is the efficacy claims are implied as well. They are implying, and they say it's clear, that we are making an efficacy claim. And so under Peel, you undertake a de novo review. Now, if you agreed with them, which is almost the premise of your question.
Let's start with that, then. Let's say I agree with them.
Yes, exactly. I just wanted to start there. Okay. And that is, if you agree with them.
I've looked at the ads.
Yes.
I've looked at what they've said about them. I think, right. Saying they're claiming that there's some efficacy.
Right. That you, what you've had, Your Honor, you've hypothesized that I've lost every stage of my case.
Correct.
And that is, and so the outcome is I'm going to lose my case. But let me just be clear on what we would have to lose. If you agree that there is a clear efficacy claim, if you agree under Pfizer that an RCT is the appropriate resolution for an efficacy claim, then those are our arguments, and we're going to lose except on our claim that the two RCT remedy is too broad. So we have a remedial objection to the order.
So let's talk about that.
Okay. Now, can I just bracket the point that they do not defend the application of Pfizer? Full stop. We briefed in this court that their application, the commission's application of the Pfizer factors, was completely contrary to past practice and unreasonable. And their brief does not argue to the contrary at all. So it would be an extreme ruling against us to say that notwithstanding the fact that they haven't defended that part of the commission's ruling, we nonetheless lose it. But you have asked me to assume.
They haven't abandoned it either.
It's in
the commission's ruling. It's pretty extensive. I don't see any implication in the red brief that they're not standing on it.
It's true, but we have briefed it extensively, and they haven't answered it all. But you asked me to assume that we nonetheless lose. Fine. So you asked me to turn to the remedy. Okay. And you were asking me to explain our argument with respect to the remedy and its overbreadth.
Well, actually, I was primarily concerned first with establishing that. Given the predicates I laid down, that's where we would end up.
Yes, that's
looking
where we
at the remedy.
Up. Yes.
Okay. So now, looking at the remedy on overbreadth.
Yeah.
Just briefly enumerate the objections.
All right. Our principle.
I know one is the Mr. Tupper's inclusion. What else?
Yes. Absolutely. Number two is that the precedents of the courts looking at fencing in remedies pay significant amount of attention to whether it is that there was an ongoing, essentially willful, purposive violation of the commission's rules. That is to say, we've really got to hit these people and make sure they don't do anything prophylactically, because these are people we suspect are going to continue to do things like this. And there is no reasonable way to find that in this case, because we're right when we say that this is a new approach to finding even efficacy claims. That is, the implication that they are drawing, notwithstanding the fact that our ads have 6 or 7 or 8 qualifications, that it nonetheless contains a clear implication, is a new approach that wasn't previewed to us at the time we were doing the advertisements. There's no reason to suspect that we would continue doing this. And our last point is that if you were to find the efficacy claim, you are overwhelmingly, we think, likely to find it with respect to ads, as I mentioned this for the Chief Judge briefly, from 2005 forward, you know, figures 1, 2, 3, 4. I think it would be very, with respect, I think it would be very hard to find it with respect to ads that we have been running for the last 6 years or so. And that makes it substantially,
I don't know. At what point do we evaluate it? Is this when the complaint was filed or when the decision issued? Is at what point do we ask whether the commission reasonably inferred danger of recurrence?
Fair enough. And that is, you certainly can't give us credit for the date after the injunction. That would be silly. Of course we haven't made the claims before that. But up to that point.
Which is what, 2013?
Yes. So up to that point, however, we were completely free. We were under no injunction whatsoever. We were running health advertising. You can look at what
it is.
We were
also in litigation with the commission.
Fair enough, but I don't think anyone could suggest that we had been acceding to the commission's position. What I'm saying to you, Your Honor,
starting on what date did things get better, do you think?
I think that it got materially better in 2005 and then again in 2007.
It got better?
Yes.
So the ad that concerns me is dated June 2007.
Yes, that the press release.
15, Exhibit 15.
The 15, ED press release.
Right. So if I were to conclude that is also a bad ad,
yes,
then I couldn't buy this argument? Is that what you're talking
about? No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And that is, I think there's a world of difference when we're talking about a broad prophylactic ban on speech to say, I look at this press release, I think that, and quite reasonably, you could conclude, is your view, that they should have disclosed this other metric. And therefore, this entire company is not going to be allowed to make health claims with respect to any products, water or the like, without two RCTs, which I think we have established and the commission did not dispute in its order, are essentially unknown in the healthy food context, because it's all but impossible to do an RCT that would meet the commission standard.
I thought they concluded with respect to pomegranate juice that that's not the case.
No, Your Honor. What they concluded, they've said two things in their order. Number one is that if an RCT...
The problem is the double-blind part, is that right?
I'm sorry?
Is the problem the double-blind part?
No, there's a variety of problems, including the cost when you can't patent the good.
But they addressed all those in their Pfizer analysis, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And so what they say in the end with respect to RCTs is, look, don't make the claim, even if it is extremely hard. And remember, while we do have a couple of RCTs ourselves, which is the commission's appellate lawyer's point, they always claim that they are insufficiently powered, for example, they don't have enough people. They're not anywhere near what they regard as a sufficient RCT. They say the methodology isn't sufficient. And what we briefed to you, and what they do not contest under the Pfizer factors, is that doing an RCT, much less two RCTs, is, as a practical matter, when you're talking about what can be in the hundreds of millions of dollars for a product that can't be patented, essentially just saying you can't make any health-related claims anymore.
Well, it says for health-related claims you don't need two RCTs, right?
I'm sorry, but what they say is that if a health-related claim implies an efficacy or disease-related claim, and then they
not
say...
Not just related. It has to have a causal impact on disease prevention, effect... treatment, et cetera.
Yeah, right? Your Honor, but this is actually the pivot point where we were maybe not disagreeing, but that I was trying to make an argument to you before, and that is the commission finds disease claims whenever there is a statement about science and a statement about health. If I could just, I have been trying to.
No, but not just any statement about health. It's a statement about a disease.
No, Your Honor, can I just give you an example of why they say that and it's not true, and that's our Addendum 3. Okay.
That's the one that refers to prostate, but it doesn't contain the word cancer.
Yeah, or disease.
But cancer is a disease.
I know, but so I'm just saying it doesn't refer to either, right? So
but it refers to prostate.
Sir, there are. I mean, without getting into undue details.
Am I looking at
Addendum 3?
Yeah.
I'm off to save prostates, right?
Yeah.
Save from what? I mean, other than disease, what else could you be saving them from?
You have prostates that are not by disease. Your Honor, I mean, their position is that what you are about to read is going to clearly imply that we can cure, prevent, or reduce the risk of prostate cancer. I'm off to save prostates.
Yeah.
Man by man, gland by gland, the antioxidant superpower is 100% committed to defending healthy prostates. That is a standard.
But you could make clear that this is a health and not a disease by giving a disclaimer like the ones we suggested in Pearson.
Right. That is true. But the question is, do we have to? And the reason is, this is a classic structure function claim. Throughout the history of FDA and FTC litigation, this is a claim that we will help the structure or function of an organ of the body. And the difficulty is what the commission does. So, Judge Srinivasan, you said in terms, yes, it's when you refer to disease or cancer. And this is an example, and there are plenty of others, that's not their rule, and that is they infer any reference to the health of an organ to be a reference to, you know, stopping disease.
I understand. I'm still stuck on the disclaimer possibility, which will allow you to keep this ad as long as you're saying that we're not talking about prevention or cure of any disease. We're just talking about health.
Your Honor, I agree with that. So I'm not disagreeing with you. The question instead is what Pearson says, what the courts, the case law of all the courts have said, is if you are clearly implying, then you need the disclaimer. My point is that the standard...
That's not what Pearson says. That's not at all what Pearson says.
Your Honor...
It has nothing to do with whether you're clearly implying. This is a case where we said it was only potentially because it could be fixed by a disclaimer. So if you have this one in front of you, if it can be fixed by a disclaimer, it's only potentially, not clearly.
Right, Your Honor, but it has to potentially... It is potentially in the following sense, and that is... It's potentially in the sense of referring to the disease. When you have had throughout the history of food and drug advertising in this country, references to what are called structure function claims, and that is you just refer to the organ, that has never been regarded as an implication that you will stop, prevent, treat, or cure disease. If that is the view the court is going to adopt, it will genuinely radically transform the requirements for food, nutrition, drug labeling.
Can I just ask you a question about this particular ad?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to this. So there's an asterisk, and it says $25 million in vision and medical research, asterisk, and then it says prostate study details at the following website address.
Yeah.
If you were to look at those study details, would those be studies that dealt with prostate cancer, or would they be with healthy prostates?
I don't know the answer. Because it's a question. I know what our websites say now. I can tell you that I don't know what it said at the time, so I won't make a representation to you. I will say that it wasn't a part of the Commission's analysis that something was incorporated by reference here.
Mr. Goldstein, in the Commission's brief at 73, footnote 33.
If you just give me 1 second, Your Honor.
Sure.
Okay, I'm there.
They say, if petitioners run future ads with effectively qualified disease claims, they would be subject only to Part 3 of the Commission's remedial order, which does not require RCT certification. And in that respect, treats petitioners the same as any other commercial advertisers. Do you disagree with that?
I don't think that's clear from the face of the Commission's order. I think they're bound to it by the Commission's representation. What I will say about...
Representation where?
In
the brief.
Oh, okay.
Right. They've told the court, and the court would be ruling on the basis
but
of...
It's an interesting question as to whether they're bound by that. My question is it consistent with the order on its face? And I'll ask the Commission that as well, of course.
I think it is consistent with. I don't think it's clear from.
Well, so then, if that's the case, doesn't it put you into the health section, not the disease section?
Well, Your Honor, our point about this is that the Commission is quite cagey about what a disclaimer is in this section. And then you have to look elsewhere ask what it is they mean by an effective disclaimer.
Well, the only examples that the Commission gives says if you gave them like in Pearson, and we were very specific in Pearson with examples of disclaimers.
The reason that it is not fair to read the Commission's order to embrace Pearson is to say that the Commission would consider them, not that they would be sufficient. And point two is that the court said if you are going to adopt a standard with respect to disclaimers, and say that other disclaimers, other qualifications are not sufficient, you're going to have actual evidence.
It also said, though, I take your point about consider, because you're right, of course, about that, but it also then went on to say, the Commission, I'm talking about the order, without such disclaimers, i.e. the disclaimers that were at issue in Pearson, respondents' ads are deceptive and misleading.
Okay, so, that's true. We're on just a different axis of the case, and that is, I took the question to be, do you have a very serious objection to this remedy, given that the remedy would accept disclaimers? My answer to that is that what they are saying they would accept as a disclaimer is substantively unreasonable. They have explained to you what it is that they regard as a sufficient disclaimer on page 3 and on page 47 of their brief. And that is well beyond what Pearson would require. And my point to you, the second point I made, Your Honor, is that the court in Pearson said, this is a speech restriction, you are going to have evidence.
This was in advance, though. This was a case where we were not looking at specific advertisements and saying whether, as already published, they were misleading or not. We were saying what had to be done for the future. Now we're actually looking at ads where in their view, there are no sufficient disclaimers, and they're telling you the disclaimers you have are not sufficient.
Right. So, Your Honor, I was asking Judge Ginsburg's question about prospective. Remember, he was asking me.
Right, but I understand that. But there's a difference between the relief for somebody who has already violated the act and the question of whether somebody is liable in the first place. That's what the Colgate-Palmolive is about. This is about fencing in. And you can give, according to the Supreme Court, you can give stronger fencing in requirements than you could have in the initial decision about liability. Isn't that right?
Yes. Okay. But my point is that there are, of course, also limits on what you can do.
Yes, of course.
Right? And if the question that I took was put to me was, look, they say you have to have two RCTs when you make certain health claims, but the commission is telling us that if you have an appropriate disclaimer, then you won't have to have two RCTs. And what I have said is, well, they set a disclaimer bar very high without any evidence that justifies that high a bar. My point, Your Honor, is that this is an exceptionally strong remedial measure, and it is one that goes well beyond what's necessary given, so for example, your concern about the 2007 press release, that is a sweeping injunctive prophylactic remedy that we don't think is justified. The only final point, and if you would just indulge me this one thing, the only final point I have been trying to make to you is the question of whether they really fairly are implying these claims well beyond taking your point about the press release, because there are, of course, 34 different ads. And I do just think that we have a really good illustration of how it is that they can't be fairly reading the ads and that they're applying a legal standard. And so it is just our Addendum 1. And this, Your Honor, I've specifically chosen one that so it's not biased in our favor. This one is going to refer to health and to disease, so to take their point, and it's going to have a medical.
It's also one that the ALJ did not find?
The ALJ did not find that it represented a disease claim, which we think is a point in our favor, because they're saying, yes, Your Honor, decompress. They're saying it clearly finds a disease claim, despite the fact that the ALJ didn't find one. So, amaze your cardiologist, clearly a health reference, taking their point. Drink Palm Wonderful pomegranate juice. And I'm going to reference six different disclaimers in here, and they're going to nonetheless say it's a clear representation that it prevents, cures, or reduces the risk of heart disease. It helps guard your body against free radicals. Unstable molecules that emerging science suggests aggressively destroy and weaken healthy cells in your body and contribute to disease. Palm Wonderful Pomegranate Juice is supported by $20 million of initial scientific research from leading universities, which has uncovered encouraging results. The Commission's legal rule is that because it references the health and encouraging results in prostate and cardiovascular health, because it has that reference and it refers to science, then it
and
is...
And it refers to disease.
Yes, it has a reference, contribute to disease.
Yeah.
And they're saying that it is a claim of scientific proof that we will cure, prevent, or reduce the risk of heart disease.
And you agree this is nothing like the disclaimers we suggested in Pearson?
Yes.
Saying emerging or anything like that, that's not enough from the Pearson point of view.
Right, but Pearson isn't setting a floor.
No, but you were relying on Pearson, and there's nothing in Pearson that suggests that this kind of disclaimer would have been sufficient.
No, the point we're relying on for Pearson is a different one, and that is the Commission's position is that because they concluded that the advertisement is inherently misleading, you have to defer to that judgment. That is the argument the FDA made as well. This court said that's almost frivolous, that we have to look just to the agency and that say that consumers will be almost hypnotized by the advertisement. The commission, there's no deference whatsoever given to the FDA's view that it is inherently misleading. And if I were just to take you to the doctrinal point that I think is really important, and that is, this court, they quote dictum in Thompson Medical that says you defer to their judgment that an ad is clear.
Can I just ask you,
yes,
when you read the portion of Pearson, you read the part that we thought was frivolous.
Yeah.
We then went on to say, but the government's alternative
Your
argument.
Your Honor, could I just make sure that I'm on? I have Pearson here. If you just tell, I just
well,
want
it's
to.
Well, it's right after the sentence you read, which is at page 655 of the Federal Reporter. Paragraph that begins in re RMJ.
Yes.
The sentence you read that says, we think this contention is almost frivolous, we reject it. That's the sentence you just read.
Yeah.
The next sentence, but the government's alternative argument is more substantial. It is asserted that health claims on dietary supplements should be thought at least potentially misleading because the consumers would have difficulty in independently verifying these claims.
Yes.
Right.
That's right. And so, absolutely, and that is the court says that those statements could be regarded as in the box of potentially misleading,
yes,
and prospectively,
yes,
as with the remedy here, that you could look at disclaimers. Your point,
right, and the,
is
and the definition of potentially, we said, is one that could be cured by a disclaimer, correct?
Correct. Now, just to be clear, that is one application of potentially. What potentially means doctrinally is that it has to satisfy Central Hudson.
Well, and, you know, so this is a quotation from Appeal and from RMJ. All say the same thing about what potentially mean. It's potentially misleading if the information also may be presented in a way that is not deceptive. That's what both our court and the Supreme Court in two other cases said the meaning of potentially is.
Well, Your Honor, I completely understand that. In the context, both Peel and Pearson are addressing the question of whether a disclaimer would solve it. I don't think the language that you're quoting is the definition of what potentially misleading means. There, the court, I think, is describing there, when the Supreme Court has described categories of speech that, because they aren't inherently false or misleading and therefore outside the First Amendment, this is a fairly straightforward doctrinal point.
It is, but I think you've gotten it wrong. That's the problem.
Okay, well,
I think that it is true that we followed Central Hudson, but when we followed Central Hudson, we had no problem with the first two steps. The only issue in Pearson had to do with the third step.
Yeah.
That is there a less restrictive way by having a disclaimer?
Yeah.
So you can say that we follow Central Hudson or not, but the relevant question is there a potential disclaimer? Isn't that right?
Well, in Pearson, but Your Honor, we really aren't saying different things, and that is, I think we're both agreeing that there's this category that you are applying Central Hudson in Pearson, and the Central Hudson objection is the overbreadth of the remedy,
correct,
and you say that you have to look at disclaimers. So I'm right, I believe, that you're in the Central Hudson box, and you're saying Pearson has a specific Central Hudson concern. So we're not disagreeing.
Right.
My point is that when you are in that box and subject to Central Hudson, you have to make the de novo determination of whether the ads are, it's clear that the ads are inherently misleading. And there's a really important point.
Misleading without the qualifier.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. But with the qualifiers that are in there.
Yeah,
okay,
right, without another qualifier.
Just remember, exactly, Your Honor, what we are saying to you is extremely modest in the following critical sense, and that is, our position is that the Commission decided that these ads were inherently misleading with no evidence whatsoever, which is unusual in First Amendment context. What we are saying, the doctrinal pivot point in the case, is that the path they went down is that when they are not going to use any evidence at all.
You mean extrinsic evidence?
Extrinsic evidence. I apologize. In this case, it is all the evidence, but you're right that that's what's being described as extrinsic evidence. Expert testimony, it doesn't even have to be consumer reports. Expert testimony, anything of the sort. It was purely the Commission's judgment that all 34 ads intrinsically and inherently made this claim. And our position, and the correct description of the law is, if they are not going to put on any evidence, unlike every other actor on every other level of every part of the government, to support their determination that speech is false and therefore can be banned, it has to be clear on its face, and you have to reach that conclusion de novo.
Before you sit down, you agree this does make an efficacy claim?
I don't think it makes an efficacy claim because of all the qualifications. Emerging science potentially suggests initial.
You agree it makes an efficacy claim, which it then qualifies.
A qualified efficacy claim, that's right. But it is really important that the judgment of the Commission is that it is an unqualified. What the Commission's rule does is it takes all of the qualifications. This is the beginning of Claim Appendix A, which is quoted at page 7 of our reply brief. It takes all the qualifications, reads them out, and says, we're going to treat every one of these as an unqualified statement. And that's the legal problem, is that that's why, Your Honor, they aren't doing this case by case and contextually. They just delete all of the qualifications.
But they delete them for a reason, right?
I'm sorry?
They delete them for a reason. I mean, they actually take a look at the qualifications and they make the assessment, and I take it you disagree with it, but they make the assessment that those qualifications don't actually improve things. In fact, they may even exacerbate things because they use positive language like encouraging.
I agree with that. And what I'm saying to you is that as a matter of law, when you have initial pilot study suggests encouraging results, if I'm going to try and describe to a human being that I have an initial pilot study that has encouraging results, that, A, I have to be able to say it, and, B, that's the opposite of saying I have scientific proof. I just don't understand what it is that the court would expect us to say in the advertisements. If we want to say, I understand we could add additional qualifications, but in the question of whether it's false speech that can be banned and we can be sanctioned for it, if I can't say I have initial science that it's has encouraging results, and they refuse to even put on any evidence that their reading of the ads is correct, but that's what I think is okay.
If there had been consumer evidence on this, you wouldn't be making this.
It would be a very different case. That the doctrinal pivot point in the case is the Supreme Court's decision in Peel, responding to Justice O'Connor's dissent, saying where she says it was another agency, another administrative determination that speech was inherently misleading. And the court says that threshold question we have to assess de novo because there's no evidence offered to support it.
That's as a plurality decision, right?
Yes, but I believe that the court agrees as well. This is an application of Bose. There isn't really a dispute, I think, anymore that Bose was the Thompson Medical brackets the question of whether Bose extends to commercial speech. I believe that's now settled as a matter of doctrine.
I thought in Novartis afterwards we looked at that question and said that notwithstanding intervening events, the old standard still continues to apply. I thought that's what specifically considered in Novartis.
I'll be perfectly honest, and that is, including because I don't think the Commission has relied on that. Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Further questions?
Thank you.
Okay, we'll hear from the other side. Your opponent went 40 minutes over, so we'll give you some leeway. But not 40 minutes worth.
I thought that they should go 40 minutes under.
If you go 40 minutes under, he won't get a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Nectarline for the Federal Trade Commission. I do actually, Judge Fender-Boston, want to pick up on that last point about Novartis. In fact, footnote 4 of Novartis, which I have right here, says, Novartis contends we should review the Commission's findings de novo, relying on Bose, in which the Supreme Court rejected the clearly erroneous standard for appellate review of an actual malice finding. This Court, however, has already concluded that Bose does not change the standard of review in deceptive advertising cases. And for that proposition, it cites both Brown and Williamson and also the Seventh Circuit's decision in Kraft. And I want to stress that Kraft addressed the argument that Mr. Goldstein was just making at great length and rejected it, because he fundamentally...
Which exact argument are you referring to?
The argument that you apply de novo review on a question of ad interpretation at the threshold. The Seventh Circuit considered that issue in Kraft and in light of Peel and rejected it. And this Court later held the same thing in Novartis. So that First Amendment issue is, in fact, settled, but it's settled in favor of the traditional deferential review that the FTC typically gets in deceptive advertising cases. Now, the FTC gets a lot of deceptive advertising cases, and the whole game in advertising is to try to sell products, obviously, but you also have to be forthright in the way that you do it. And so advertisers are always walking the line between effective salesmanship and forthrightness. And the choice of qualifiers that you put in an ad to make sure the consumers are not deceived is a recurring issue that the FTC has addressed for decades. And it's precisely because the FTC has addressed these issues for decades that it gets the deference that this Court has given it. Now, in the joint appendix at pages 801 and 802, there is an extended discussion of the FTC's regime for deciding what sorts of disclaimers or qualifications are needed to avoid having consumers be deceived when they are confronted with claims that particular dietary supplements like these Pom-X pills or the Pom juice can cure particular diseases.
This is an FTC publication. Right?
It is an FTC publication. This is the 2001 Dietary Supplements Guide. It just codifies FTC law on substantiation standards as well as what constitutes an adequate qualification. And this document also informed the Commission's decision here as well, and this Court cited this document approvingly in Daniel Chapter 1. So I just want to read a few statements from the Dietary Supplements Guide. The advertiser should make sure consumers understand both the extent of scientific support and the existence of any significant contrary evidence. That's consistent with Pearson. Vague qualifying terms, for example, the product may have the claimed effect or helps achieve the claimed benefit, are unlikely to be adequate. And finally, the FTC requires a disclosure that clearly describes the limitations of the research and states unambiguously that additional research is necessary to confirm the preliminary results. This is also, by the way, similar to the analogous regime that the FDA has now adopted in the wake of this court's decision in Pearson. If you have a dietary supplement and you want to make disease claims in your labeling, then you have to negotiate effective qualifiers with the FDA beforehand. Our regime is more liberal and permissive than that because you don't have to come to us first to get permission to make particular claims, and then we will review them afterwards. But we do apply consistent rules about the extent to which advertisers of dietary supplements may make claims that particular products treat or prevent particular diseases.
Now, Mr. Goldstein pointed to some portions in your brief where you itemize some features of a potential qualifying disclaimer.
That is correct. I mean, it's telling that he cited the portion of our brief that deals with the ED claims. And that's actually a close case, because another point that the 2001 guide makes clear is that there comes a time when the evidence against your claim in the record is so substantial that it may be very difficult to qualify the claim to avoid deception. And this court makes that point again in Pearson. And with respect to the ED claims, it's actually a close question whether POM could adequately qualify its report on the Forrest Padmanathan study in order to avoid consumer deception, given that it had two metrics of efficacy, one of which was validated and they came nowhere close to statistical significance, and the other of which was unvalidated, and they also fell short of statistical significance on that one as well. Maybe they can qualify this by giving consumers the full picture, but as this court pointed out in Pearson, there are sometimes cases where the evidence is so weak for you and the contrary evidence is so significant that it may not be possible.
But do you think that same series of suggested disclaimers would be necessary with respect to heart disease or prostate cancer?
Well, heart disease is sort of an interesting case, because I want to disagree with my opponent's suggestion that their ads were more controversial in the early years than in the later years. From my perspective, the ads became much more deceptive in the later years, and that's why we have three examples of later year ads attached as addenda to our brief.
By later years, you mean?
2007 on. The point, particularly with respect to heart disease, the point at which they had conducted actual RCTs, which really were placebo-controlled, double-blind trials. These are the Ornish CIMT and the Davidson CIMT studies. These studies came out, there's nothing methodologically wrong with the Davidson study in particular, and the Ornish CIMT study was quite superior to the Averam study that they continued to cite over and over again through 2010. But those studies, what's significant about them is that they were rigorous, and the only problem with them from POM's perspective is that they had negative results. And that's how they were received by the scientific community as well. They ignored those studies in their subsequent ads, as we show in addenda 1-2 of our brief. So with respect to your question,
not only ignored them, but kept on relying on the faulty study?
They continued to rely on the Averam study through 2010, and we give you two examples of that as addenda to our red brief. And they did not cite either of the two contradictory studies that they conducted later. And it is incorrect to say...
I'm sorry, what was the year of the RCT study?
I'm sorry?
What was the year of the study that was actually well-controlled?
The Ornish was in 2005. The Davidson was in 2006. Now, POM suppressed the publication of the Davidson study. It didn't bother to publish the Ornish study at all. It kept the Davidson study in limbo so that the scientific world at large didn't find out about it.
So they sponsored these two studies?
They sponsored all of these studies, as they should. I mean, it is a responsible thing to do, to sponsor studies in order to substantiate claims of disease prevention or treatment.
So is that where the $20 million or $25 million comes from?
It kept going up. It started out at $20
million. But whatever the numbers were reflected their own investment.
Not necessarily with respect only to these studies. They used numbers that actually encompassed a whole lot of things.
But their own whole lot of things or other research being done elsewhere?
This is their research. They're talking about their research budget. But some of the figures that they told consumers about actually included other things like research into unrelated diseases.
So can I ask you, for example, on the first ad that you focused on, I think it's addendum 2. So there's a statement in there about the Averam study.
Yes.
In the last paragraph. By this point, let's assume that there are other studies in effect. The type of qualifying disclaimer that you would envision making a difference would be one that necessarily requires excluding the statement about the Averam study, or would it be one that allows that statement but then contains information about the other studies as well?
I think it's actually a close question whether at that point in 2009 the totality of the scientific evidence was against them. From 2005 or 6 on, it may not have been possible for them to have qualified any reliance on the Averam study because, as the Commission's experts pointed out, the results of these later studies, and particularly the Davidson study, tended to discredit the Averam study. And it has always been FTC precedent that, if you have several different studies in your possession, I'm just reading from JA808, this is the 2001 guide, advertisers should look first to the results of the studies with more reliable methodologies. That would be the later studies that were the negative studies. And then if you go on to pages 808 and 809 in the joint appendix, the commission gives a hypothetical where you conduct two different studies, both of which are actually methodologically sound, but they point in different directions. One shows a statistically significant result. The other fails to show a statistically significant result. The commission says, given the totality of the evidence on the subject, the claim is likely to be unsubstantiated. So that may be a context in which you can't give adequate disclaimers. Maybe before 2005 and 2006, they could have relied on the Averam study if they had given adequate disclaimers of the sort that the court hypothesized in Pearson. Now, I want to address a point that my opponent has made this morning, which I think is incorrect. I'm going to read from the commission's opinion addressing their First Amendment claim. This is a passage where they talk about the significance of these later double-blind, placebo-controlled atherosclerosis studies. This is page 627 of the joint appendix. It's around the middle of the page. The commission's talking about the omissions of material facts in these ads. And obviously, an omission of a material fact is every bit as much a violation of the FTC Act as an outright misstatement. In the middle of this long paragraph, the commission reads, consumers could not verify the results of a much larger, well-designed, well-controlled study, the Davidson CIMT study, which was completed in 2006 and showed at most a 5% decrease in arterial plaque, and that's generous. In some patients measured at an interim point were inconsistent with the statement in ads running through 2009, that actually was 2010, that asserted pomegranate juice consumption resulted in significant reduction in IMT, thickness of arterial plaque, by up to 3%, 30% after 1 year, based on the unblinded Averam CIMT study, because respondents delayed publication of the negative results. They also just never mentioned the Davidson study in these ads that are attached in our brief, which both ran, both ran in 2009 in dozens of locations. And then with respect, I think, Judge Senator Lawson, you also asked whether qualifiers would be sufficient with respect to the prostate cancer claims. Now, for this one, I want to turn to addendum 3 in our brief. This is a Time magazine wrap. Subscribers would get this. If we could turn to page 2 of this. This is the one with the giant caduceus in the middle.
You better tell the audience what a caduceus is.
This describes how a recently published pilot study involving Palm Wonderful 100% Palm Organic Juice followed 46 men.
Can you hold on? This is addendum what?
Addendum 4.
Four.
So there's this caduceus in the middle, which is essentially, which is always associated with medical treatment. And then there's a long discussion of the evidence that supposedly demonstrates that the ingestion of palm products, this one focuses on juice, the later ones almost all focus on pills, will help you if you've just been subject to surgery or radiation treatment for prostate cancer. And the ad tells you that PSA doubling times should be considered particularly significant if you're a patient in those contexts. What the ad doesn't tell you a number of things. One is the ad doesn't tell you that PSA doubling times have accepted clinical significance only in a narrow context that is not presented here. It has accepted significance, as Dr. Eastham testified.
Can you get to what seems like a more important question, which is, says these men experience significantly slower average PSA doubling times, slower than who?
Slower than themselves.
Compared to any control group, not compared to somebody who drank
exactly
apple
so.
Juice, nothing?
There was no control for this experiment. And so the results here are entirely consistent with the proposition that if you have an average PSA doubling time of 15 months after your prostate surgery, that period may extend all by itself just due to normal human bodily processes.
I just want to be clear about this. Addendum 4, when it says these men experience significantly slower average PSA doubling time, all that means is slower than they experienced before surgery?
Exactly. No. They after surgery, they had 15 months for their doubling times. They were then without a control group.
After that 15 months?
After the 15 months. So there was surgery, then 15-month doubling time, then it went up. So
what you're saying is we don't know whether the consequence of the surgery or the radiation or drinking water or sitting in the sunshine is what caused the change in the time?
We would know if this were in fact a controlled trial, because then you compare these men to people who were not taking the palm juice.
They might have been on the mend anyway.
What's the date
of this one?
I'm sorry?
The date.
The date of this one, this one is 2009. You can see on the first page of this, date in, date out,
says,
July.
Yeah, 2009.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I actually want to expand on this point a little bit, because there was a very, the scientist who conducted this study, Dr. Pantuck, acknowledged that the single greatest weakness of the study is that it lacked a control group. The reason that's significant in this context is that we have other evidence that if your PSA doubling times are already that long to begin with, 15 months or longer, or for that matter, anything longer than about 3 or 4 months, we have significant evidence in the record that PSA doubling times for that group of patients tends to increase by itself anyway. We know that in the form of a study conducted in 2004 into a different drug called rosiglitazone. And none of this is disclosed in this ad. All this ad does is it gives people a sense of false assurance that if they take this product and they've just been recovering from prostate surgery or radiation treatment, that something good will happen to them and they will enjoy more years of life. But there's no scientific basis for drawing that conclusion at all. Now, the commission did not address whether or not Palm could have talked about this study if it had tacked on the various qualifying features that we just discussed, such as there's no clinical significance to PSA doubling times when they're longer than a few months. Number two, this is not a controlled study. Number three, other studies have shown the PSA doubling times for patients in this cohort tend to increase all by themselves, even without intervention. It's unclear whether if they had added those points to this, they could have continued relying on the study. That would be another case, and the commission would have to look at it. I think it's probably a close case, because this study doesn't actually prove very much.
As a procedural matter, if we're in the land where an advertiser who's subject to a remedial order like this has the opportunity to add qualifying language. Mm-hmm. What happens? So they come up with some qualifying language that they think is sufficient. And then what happens as a matter of process then? Is there a way to get some sense from the commission of the adequacy of the qualifying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, companies that are under order always have the opportunity and often take advantage of the opportunity to contact the commission about particular language that they intend to run in an ad. They don't have to do that, but they're free to do that. And, that would be available to POM as well.
Mr. Klein, as I understand it, the basic concerns underlying the whole program of the commission with respect to false advertising are of course, people are gypped out of money by purchasing something that's not serviceable, and may even be inhibited from seeking medical treatment or advice because they're relying on these representations and the product. Where in this mix is the concern raised by the First Amendment that consumers have access to as much information as is plausible or acceptable and adequately qualified? Where does that come into the mix? Is it on the same plane, or is it simply a gloss over those two that's imposed by the Supreme Court's application of the First Amendment here?
As an initial matter, the First Amendment interest in the context of commercial speech is to generate more helpful and truthful speech to the public. Okay. And sometimes that requires saying more rather than less, including qualifiers that help consumers understand.
I agree entirely with that proposition. So if there is a study, and the study meets all of the proper criteria for scientific methodology, and is invoked in an advertisement, possibly with the disclaimer that there's only one study, because that might be relevant to whether someone's misled or over-relies, then requiring a second study is essentially suppressing and preventing the publication of what would be a true and non-misleading statement.
So I believe you're at this point referring to the remedial order as opposed to the underlying liability.
That's right. That's right.
And I think that
I've long been more interested in that, as you may have noticed. Yes.
And with respect to the remedial order, I think that the findings about the willfulness of these violations are particularly significant.
Why is that relevant to the calculus we're just talking about of getting to consumers all non-harmful information?
Because there is a concern about recidivism here. I mean, we're talking about a pattern in practice that occurred over 7 years of deceiving consumers.
Why would that matter if you have a well-controlled double-blind study? I don't know, say of a million people, and it showed by 100% that Palm Wonderful cured cancer, and you would still take the position that they could not disclose that? They could not disclose that in their advertisement?
I'll address that hypothetical in a moment. But
why don't I start with that?
Okay, I'll start with that.
Seems kind of hard to me.
I think in that context, it would obviously always be appropriate for POM to come back to the commission and seek a revision. But the essential of
you know that I'm going to say 95%, and then I'm going to
say you're going to go all the way down. But here's my central point: this company has a record of distorting scientific results. Mm-hmm. In other words, it required a full investigation and hearing to lift the hood on these supposedly promising results and uncover why they did not have the integrity that POM is representing. It is easier to get away with future distortions of scientific evidence if you're held only to a 1 RCT standard to a 2 RCT standard.
Did they say that in the opinion, what you just said?
Yes. I mean, I think the commission
I'm equally concerned about this section because the FTC seemed to go out of its way to not insist on 2 RCTs as a general matter. Mm-hmm. They said, we're just, one's enough. We're not going to decide 2. And if 1 is generally enough, and they happen to have 1, yes, it's Actually, it should be easier for you to look at one than to look at two. So I'm not sure why you require two. And show me the place where it discusses what. I get the point that it's fencing in, but you have to say a little bit more than it's fencing in.
Sure. So on the bottom of page 49, mm-hmm. The last full paragraph, we agree with the ALJ's conclusion that respondents' actions were serious and deliberate. Respondents made serious yet unsupported claims about three diseases. They also made numerous deceptive representations and were fully aware that they were making such representations despite the inconsistency between the results.
No, I got all that, but that is in the section on cease and desist order, not
I thought it was on
fencing in.
The fencing in relief is within the context of defining the contours of.
No, but then you have a separate section that says fencing in provisions, which starts on the next page, and then on J635.
Yes. Okay.
That's where I think
I see.
You've got second. Respondents have a demonstrated propensity.
Yes, that is in fact the passage that was probably more relevant to this. But respondents have a demonstrated propensity to misrepresent to their advantage the strength and outcomes of scientific research. And again, this is a question of.
There are enumerated reasons there, right? The first one, you're referring to the second one right now.
Yes.
The first one is that the requirements consistent with commission precedent, citing Thompson, which the commission's own opinion on Thompson, saying no lesser standard than two well-controlled clinical tests is appropriate as a general rule for any analgesic product, which is not what we're dealing with.
If anything, that our case follows a fortiori because these are disease prevention claims rather than pain relief claims.
But as one expert explained, I didn't say what you just said, quote, even with the safeguards contained in an RCT, the results contained in any one study may be due to chance or may not be generalizable due to the uniqueness of the study sample, close quote. Well, of course, 90-95% deals with the chance element and can be explained adequately mm-hmm. in a simple disclaimer. So then you get to the second one, which is the demonstrated propensity to misrepresent to their advantage the outcomes of scientific research. That's true of anyone that's under that runs afoul of the commission's norms.
That's not necessarily correct. I mean, it's not always the case that people run clinical trials and then misrepresent the results to consumers and the public.
Okay, some don't even bother to run clinical
trials. Some don't even run clinical trials.
Okay. And then I think maybe this is part of it as well. On the next page, the requirement for two RCTs in part one of the order applies only to claims for disease, prevention, risk, reduction, and treatment. Future representations relating to efficacy or health benefits require substantiation consistent with confident, reliable scientific evidence. So you're saying that there's precedent, there's a demonstrated propensity, and this applies only in the more serious type of claims.
The commission acts on a case-by-case basis, and it acted on the basis of this record. There was disagreement in the record about how many RCTs you needed for particular types of claims in order to establish efficacy. So. The commission's experts recommended two RCTs for heart disease, and that is not what the commission determined as a matter of liability here. It didn't reach the question of whether you need one or two, but there is.
It didn't need to decide.
It did not need to decide that.
Right.
But it's a close question, and with respect to the remedy, that question is resolved. That close question on this record is resolved against. POM, precisely because it has this history.
Other than Thompson, is there any case that's required to for fencing in?
I'm not sure I'm able to answer that off the top of my head.
In Removitron, the ALJ said two, the FTC said one.
The FTC said one because that was a hair removal case mm-hmm. rather than a claim of disease prevention or treatment.
So if there's no precedent, is FTC's position that this is the worst ever advertiser that they have ever seen with respect to these kind of claims?
Well, no. Again, this is consistent with the decision in Thompson Medical, which, as this court pointed out, mm-hmm. Reflected the commission's longstanding view that you need two RCTs in a variety of circumstances.
And although when I looked at the footnote to support that, I didn't find a longstanding view.
But, okay. Well, this, the commission actually did refer back in its long opinion in Thompson Medical to prior FTC cases where it required two RCTs, for example, in cases of comparative product advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought what we said in Thompson was that the FTC is usually required two well-controlled clinical studies before such a nonspecific establishment claim may be made. So we talked about the category of nonspecific establishment claims, and apparently there was some indication that.
Correct, and that the two RCT requirements also applied in Thompson Medical to the pure efficacy claims as well.
Can I ask you a question about those? Sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to following up on the same. So where is there in the order, or I should say in the decision, any concern expressed about the suppression of true information but supported only by one RCT and any appropriate qualifier?
So are we still referring to the remedial order portion of the opinion?
Well, the order requires the, insofar as it requires two.
Yes, so we're talking about the remedy, as opposed to the underlying.
Raises for me the question, where in the order or in the underlying decision, is there any concern expressed about the cost of this, which is to say suppressing, well, I guess it's in Commissioner Olhausen, a separate footnote.
Commissioner Olhausen did reach a different result on two narrow issues, and one of them was the number of RCTs required.
Right.
That's correct.
Right. So what did the commission say in response to that?
The commission's basic approach to this is that we're talking about a single group of companies that have distorted science in the past. And if they want to qualify...
One of the companies, is that right?
Well, remember that Palm was using Roll's in-house marketing department to create these ads.
Right, but they've done. Have they offended with any regard to any other product?
Not to my knowledge, but these are the main. We're talking about one marketing organization that is housed in Roll and used by Roll and Palm.
Well, if it were an advertising agency, would you have relief against an advertising agency that would apply to all of their representation for all clients or for the one that they...
It would, my sense is that it would turn on the facts and the severity and willfulness of the violation.
All right, so go on then. So what did the commission say in response to this?
So the basic ruling here is that because these companies have misrepresented science, they should be subject to two, but remember that if they create more speech rather than less speech by adequately qualifying any future claims, then they're subject to Part 3 of the order rather than Part 1 of the order. So the order creates its own incentive.
Okay, let me ask you about that, because Part 3 deals with health claims.
Part 3 deals with any claim that is not a disease claim.
Right, okay. So insofar as they're dealing with a disease claim, and they have the one RCT, and Commissioner Olhausen's expressed concern, what's the answer?
The answer is, if you have a legitimate disease claim based on your evidence, then you should qualify it adequately so that you are under Part 3 of the order rather than Part 1 of the order.
Well, if it's a disease claim, you're still under Part 1, aren't you?
No, as we point out in a footnote to our brief, if they adequately...
Footnote 33?
I don't remember the exact number.
873?
Might well be so.
Yes. But not square that footnote with the order.
The order, I think, uses a term of art when it talks about a disease claim. And this is consistent with past FTC precedent. When the commission uses the term disease claim, it's referring to an unqualified disease claim. Effective qualification puts you into a different category.
Well, it says, if petitioners run future ads with effectively qualified disease claims, they're still disease claims.
They are not considered disease claims within the scope of this order. This is how we read the order.
You do say that in the footnote. Then they would be under Part 3.
Yes.
I just can't find it in the order.
This is how we interpret the order. We believe it is, and this is how we use it. The term disease claim, as it is shown here, is a bit of a term of art, but it refers to an unqualified claim about prevention or treatment of diseases.
Yes. Okay, now that context, you will understand, explanation doesn't appear in the face of the order. Where does it appear?
I think you will search in vain for any additional explanation in the record. We are happy to be bound by the concession that we made in our brief.
Is it based on some previous writings of the FTC or anything like that?
I think it is just based on the traditional understanding that the term disease claim means a claim about the prevention or treatment of diseases that is not adequately qualified.
Is there some FTC opinion that says that that's what a disease claim is?
Or? I can't give you the site off the top of my head.
I assume that, but since you didn't know what the footnote number was. But do you think you could find one?
We will file a supplemental letter.
Great.
Mr. Mechtelein, it may just be in the folkways and practice and local understanding of the commissioner. It may be expressed somewhere in writing. If it's not, it doesn't mean that you're wrong about the practice. You say to be, you're happy to interpret the commission. It interprets its own order in the way that is explained in the footnote.
That's correct.
That we just discussed. So is the commission, if the commission is happy with the interpretation that's expressed, it's advanced in the brief, is it also happy to conform the order to make that express?
I can't speak for the commission. I'm happy to file a supplemental letter.
I think that would be very useful.
Can I ask you a question about the order, too? Just one last question, which is...
I got some more, so don't.
Okay.
He's only at 19 minutes.
Which is one thing that leaped out to me is that the order runs for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And where does that time frame come from? I take it that that's standard fare. But even if it is, where does that time frame come from?
It is standard fare. I mean, it's...
But why? Why 20 years for a prophylactic remedy?
I don't know. They have not specifically challenged 20 as opposed to 10 or some other figure. But I'm happy to include that in the supplemental letter.
Okay.
See if we can think of some more. Right. Are you done?
Yeah, that's the.
Are you conceding that the Pfizer analysis is indefensible?
Absolutely not. I'm
surprised to hear that. But I don't want to see a supplemental letter. I'd like you to tell us.
You're not going
to
see a supplemental letter. With respect to the Pfizer analysis, remember, 34 of these 36 ads contained establishment claims as well as efficacy claims. It is always the case that the substantiation requirements for establishment claims are at least as rigorous as those for efficacy claims. And as a result, it is almost gilding the lily to focus specifically on the efficacy claims, but the commission, we stand by the commission's reasoning and the opinion.
For an establishment claim, there has to already be an efficacy claim. Is that right?
An establishment
generally
claim implies an efficacy claim,
yes. Okay. Is the holding of the opinion that all that's required is a logical connection? That's the sentence that opposing counsel pointed out between the claims and
no.
What
the
is the holding
of the commission is that ads that draw a causal connection between a product and disease treatment or prevention are without adequate qualification are disease claims.
So it has to be causal, not just a logical connection.
Yes.
What about this question of whether...
Now, it could be an express or an implied causal connection.
I understand. What about this question of whether we need to look at the ads that the ALJ found against the FTC? In order to support the injunction.
In order to support the injunctive relief, I think the fair reading of the passage in the order dealing with why the commission is imposing the order that it is based on POM's longstanding pattern and practice of deceiving consumers by distorting science. And against that backdrop, it would appear that the same result would be appropriate whether the number of ads that are deceptive here are 30 versus 36 or 20 versus 36.
I take it, well, do you agree with Mr. Goldstein that if we agree with the commission that there are efficacy claims in every one of these ads and that the commission's Pfizer analysis is adequate with respect to those, that we needn't deal with the substantiation aspects of the commission's order any more than the commission needed to deal on the liability side with the number of RCTs?
Remember that substantiation is one of the six Pfizer factors. So the sixth Pfizer factor is the degree of substantiation that experts in the field would recommend.
Fair enough, but without reference to that.
Yes, yes. I mean, the commission found that all 36 ads had efficacy claims. 34 of the 36 also had establishment bias.
But, and found that with an efficacy claim, the only way to make that is if you have one RCT. Is that correct?
In the circumstances presented, there's no qualification.
Yes.
You're talking about the prevention or treatment of serious diseases, two of which are potentially lethal. Mm-hmm. On this record.
I understand all the limitations.
And where the established, particularly where the establishment claims are about the integrity of clinical trials. In that context, the commission said, yes, you must show statistically significant results from real science.
Mr. Nickthorne, what reason is there to think that Mr. Tupper is likely to recidivate?
Mr. Tupper was the head of marketing who was directly involved in most or all of these ads and was also the liaison between the marketing crew and the scientists who were compiling the studies that the ads are about. He was the hub of this entire enterprise.
Well, that's true. I think. But it's also true, I think, that he passed everything he said then on through the legal clearance. Right? He's not a lawyer. He has left the company, I think, before the injunction issued, or the order from the FTC. Mm-hmm. Do we know if he's alive?
He is alive.
Do we know what he does for a living?
I do not know. I do know, but the issues are outside the record, and so I'm not going to speculate about them here. I do know
that speculated that he might come back into the industry.
That is on the face of the record. Yes.
Now he said there's a factual finding from the ALJ that he has retired, and that he will not again work for this company or its affiliates.
That is correct. He will not. It is represented that he will not work for this company or its affiliates. I don't know whether.
That's a factual finding.
I'm sorry?
I think that's a finding of fact, that
yes.
He will not just that he said he wouldn't. But in any event, it doesn't say he's retired from all work.
Correct. It doesn't say, and remember, the order only refers to advertising about foods and dietary supplements. So the order would not affect Mr. Tupper to the extent that he enters a different industry, for example. But to the extent that he's making representations about the ability of dietary supplements like these to cure or prevent diseases, then yes, the order will apply to him, and it should.
Did this issue of him, of the fact that he's not with the company any longer, was that a basis for a challenge before the FTC? Because I didn't see that addressed in the FTC's order.
I can tell you that in the record there was some argument about how Mr. Tupper shouldn't be subject to the order because he no longer works with the company.
Uh-huh.
That's sort of irrelevant because, you know, the marketing people can go from company to company, and people who have been engaged in deceptive advertising are commonly subject to orders, even if they don't stay in the same company where they committed the misconduct.
This is the rats leaving the sinking ship. Probably.
There you go.
Well, this is like security brokers who leave one particular brokerage.
Yes.
And nonetheless have a cease and desist order. Further questions? Congratulations on only being 26 minutes over.
Thank you.
I guess I don't need to do my usual question, which is, does Mr. Goldstein have any time left? All right, Mr. Goldstein, we'll give you some more time, but it would be helpful if what you did was answer questions from the bench rather than...
Sure, and I was also going to just focus on the remedy. I think the court has focused on it, and so while we disagree, obviously, with the finding of liability, it seems the court's focused
Fair
on
enough.
Remedy.
Fair enough.
So,
but you're not in agreement with Commissioner Olhausen either, are you?
Well, there are parts of Commissioner Olhausen's position that we do agree with. Obviously, there are parts that we don't. She would have required one RCT. The key part that she would have required that we think is important is that for many of these advertisements, she agrees with us, the commission can't just deem the ads false. It would have required extrinsic evidence. On the question of liability, if you're going to... The questions were principally about one RCT versus two RCTs.
You're talking about remedy?
On remedy.
Yes, yes. I apologize.
Apologize.
On remedy, one RCT versus two RCT. I want to talk about the question of whether one RCT is appropriate. The commission's position and the argument to you is that we are recidivist. And so I think it's very important for you to focus on what the actual basis for the commission's finding of liability was, and also whether 1RCT would be appropriate if the court were just to rule on the basis of the efficacy claims. Now, you have been pointed to page 43, my friend quoted it, of the commission's opinion for the proposition that the commission ruled on the basis that we suppressed science. Our point is that that is not at all the commission's liability finding. That paragraph, it's JA 627, addresses avowedly only, he says it's in the first, in response to our First Amendment argument. So I'm at 627.
This is in a paragraph called, in a section called inherently misleading, right?
That's right. Yeah. But the argument that they're responding to is purely and exclusively whether our claims are verifiable. It is not at all a basis for the commission's imposition of liability. The commission is unambiguous about the basis for the imposition of liability, which is its statement that the basis, this is at 587, the basis of petitioner's liability is their lack of sufficiently reliable evidence, namely RCTs, to substantiate the claims that we found.
I'm having a little trouble following this. The paragraph that you're reading from, which is the one on 43, begins with a sentence. Respondents assert that the statements in their ads also are objectively accurate and verifiable, not just verifiable, sure, but accurate. And then it goes into a discussion of the omissions of material facts.
Right, but can I just read? I apologize, because it is the part of the argument that they're addressing here is purely verifiability. We agree, I'm going to be seven lines down the line, yeah, that starts RMJ. We agree that many of the facts in respondents' ads are verifiable. However, there are many omissions of material facts in respondents' ads that consumers cannot verify independently. And then it makes the two points that Mr. Nectarline pointed to. This is not a liability finding. The basis for liability is not a commission determination that we suppressed science and misled consumers about it. It is, and remember, you were concerned, Chief Judge Garland, before that I was reading a single sentence or two sentences out of the course of an entire order. The commission's basis for liability is it found that we were making unqualified disease claims and we had to have an RCT to support them.
That's now, at 587?
Yes. It is at 587 and also 604, if I could just read you one other two sentences. We consider only the claims that is found by the commission, the respondent made in this case, that the challenged POM products to treat, prevent, or reduce the risk of heart disease, prostate cancer, and ED, and that such claims are scientifically established. The expert evidence was clear that RCTs are necessary for adequate substantiation of these representations. That's its explanation of the liability finding.
I'm sorry, where on the page is that?
Okay, let me just turn to 604.
Isn't that distinguishing? I mean, this is a very long opinion, and it's a little hard to do this back and forth,
yes,
but that appears to be in a paragraph distinguishing between health claims and disease claims. Because that's what the previous sentence says. We need not determine the level of substantiation required to support or to all health claims. I took the next sentence to just mean we are not dealing with health claims. We are dealing with disease claims, claims that they are that they've made these claims of efficacy, and also claims that they are scientifically established.
Yes, I understand. We're saying the same thing. But what I'm saying is when they say we consider only,
yeah,
in these passages, it's explaining why they held us liable. What they are not, there aren't in these passages, if the liability determination, if you just read, you know, I'm not obviously going to do that now. If afterwards you have the opportunity to read the discussion of the liability.
I will have the opportunity.
Sure.
That's
okay.
It's a great thing about being an appellate judge.
Next.
We have all this time to read the briefs.
All right, so next.
But your takeaway there is that we consider only the disease claims.
Well, my takeaway is that call them efficacy claims, call them establishment claims. Mr. Nectarline's, the thrust of his argument that we are recidivists that deserve this harsh fencing in remedy is that the commission found us liable for suppressing science and creating this misleading impression on the behalf in the consumer's mind. In fact, what the commission held us liable for was not having a particular level of substantiation. And that, in terms of the level of remedy that is necessary and appropriate, those are wildly different things. His answer to you about why would one RCT be insufficient was that, well, these people, the commission found them liable for misrepresenting the science. Point two, his argument is that we are recidivists because it has been plain for a long time, as opposed to in the course of this order, that the commission requires two RCTs.
Actually, just back up,
sure,
one sentence. What he actually said was that the commission found a been ready to remedy, a propensity to distort the science. Right? That was what you said justified.
Yes, I think that my point about that, Your Honor, is that when the commission is explaining what it means to distort the science, that is what they are talking about, and that is they believed, we claimed, that we had scientific clinical proof that we would prevent, cure, or treat the disease, and that we did not have it. Right? They claimed we asserted impliedly a level of substantiation that we did not have. That is a different kettle of fish from saying, and you can look at the liability part of the opinion, a very different matter from saying that they held us liable for suppressing science, which would be a different case. So, if I could turn...
Are you taking suppressing as meaning something different than omissions of material facts?
Oh, I apologize. So, what I'm talking about here, the commission's brief goes page after page after page after page, as we pointed out in our reply, without any citation to the commission's opinion, when it says, we suppressed science, we omitted other studies, and the like. That is not the basis, as a, you know, under Chenery, for the ruling that is in front of you, and it is not the basis for the remedy either.
I understand your point about the remedy. I'm still having trouble about why the statement about omitting the studies isn't a basis for the liability determination.
Your Honor, the best that I can do, because I do think it's complete, is that that appears in one paragraph of the opinion only, and it is only dealing with the question of responding to our First Amendment argument that our claims are verifiable. The commission was saying the following. You cited a study, and you tell us that you have a First Amendment right to say the study, notwithstanding our finding of liability. That's not correct, because the reader couldn't verify the truth of the ad because it didn't know that there were other contrary studies. That's the discourse that's going on in the exchange between the commission and us. That is completely well after the commission's finding of liability, which was on the basis of you don't have RCTs, which you are impliedly representing that you do have. That's what's going on in that exchange. And that's why it's only in one paragraph. I think we would recognize that in this extensive opinion by the FTC, that if it believed it could and was holding us liable for suppressing science and omitting science, rather than not having the level of substantiation, and I have quoted the sentence that explains their basis of liability, they would have said it more than just the three sentences.
So what they said on 635 is where they're talking about why you have the two RCT requirement.
Yeah.
And this is in the paragraph that begins second, in the middle of the paragraph.
Yeah.
Like the ALJ, the commission finds that respondents have engaged in a deliberate and consistent course of conduct, no mere isolated incident or mistake, in deceptively touting the challenged POM product's purported ability to affect diseases and the scientific studies ostensibly showing such effects?
That's my point. And that is, they're saying they believe that we impliedly claim RCT level of substantiation. And they said that's deceptive because we didn't have RCT. What this is not saying is that we were suppressing science, we were omitting science. The basis, they're just referring back to their liability finding.
So our discussion with Mr. Nechtlein about the subsequent studies that didn't reference and so on, you're saying is not
the basis for liability or the basis for the remedy. Okay. Point two is the question of whether we should be held liable as recidivists. And Mr. Lechterlein's point is that the requirement of having RCTs predates this case. And he points to two things. The first is the FTC's dietary supplements guidelines. And then he says, with respect to the pills and with respect to the juice, the absolute incorrect part of that assertion is that juice is not regarded as a dietary supplement. That is remember, when the FTC, he says, has been doing this for decades. And the only support that he can point you to in terms of a publication of the FTC is something about dietary supplements, which this juice does not qualify as. It is a substantial piece of evidence that they have not done this before. The second thing that they do is point you to the statement in this court's decision in Thompson Medical, where this court said that FTC in the past has required two RCTs. As we point out in our brief, that is not accurate. It is referring only to, and if you read the FTC's own opinion in Thompson Medical, it is referring only to when you are dealing with an over-the-counter drug. And I have, if I can just give you three citations, because it's not accurate that in the food or juice context they had required RCTs, and this is important in deciding whether it's appropriate for the commission to regard us as recidivists. Tropicana, so it's 140 FTC 176, Unither 136 FTC 145, and body-wise, 2005 Westlaw 280455, are examples of the exact opposite of what they're representing as the commission practice. And that's why they aren't citing to you other cases involving juices and foods where they were requiring two RCTs. And the reason is quite different to deal with the Aspergream case, Thompson Medical, and why he says it just follows a fortiori, is that people were, the commission found, not using aspirin, but instead were using this cream as a substitute for pain relief. And there is no allegation here that anyone was not undertaking other medical care for their health conditions as a result of our of these advertisements
what
at
mean,
all.
No extrinsic evidence, no consumer evidence?
No claim.
No claim.
That's a huge difference. The only
but thing. I thought that possibility underlies all of this inquiry.
Yes, you are, I think, reading from a sentence in their brief just then. It underlies all of the FTC's position, and what you will not find at the end of that sentence is a citation to anything. And there is no argument, no assertion in this brief, in the commission's accusation against us or the commission's order, that they are pursuing in any way, shape, or form a health-related interest. Remember, the only interest that they're pursuing is that we don't inflate the price of juice, which is a consumer interest. But it is why you can't at all fairly say that we are recidivists when we don't have two RCTs, when they have only required them, if ever, in the context of over-the-counter medication. And so I think while we disagree with the finding of liability, if you find that there is an efficacy claim or if you are nonetheless to affirm across the board with respect to the commission, we have to recognize the seriousness of the commission's remedy, and you have to decide whether that ban on speech is appropriate when, I think objectively, this standard, the RCT standard, and the implication the commission is drawing was not known to us ahead of time.
Further questions from the bench? Thank you. We'll take it under submission. Oh, you have something more you want to say? I don't know. How many minutes over was he?
I'll take 1 minute. Just a couple.
We don't have sur rebuttal, so if you have a fact you want to
yes.
tell us.
I would like to direct the court to the FTC's enforcement policy statement on food advertising of May 1994. That relates to substantiation of claims when you use foods as a basis for arguing about disease treatment or prevention. The dietary supplements guide follows the food guide. Dietary supplements and foods are treated alike when they are marketed as a potential treatment or prevention of disease mechanism.
All right. You owe us a supplemental filing
yes.
on the other questions.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Take recess.